It's Philosophy Talk.
When we succeed because we do things together.
Humans are social animals. We do things together to get things done.
There is no I in team, but there's no we in team either.
Doesn't all cooperative activity involve joint intentions, joint planning, and joint action?
Aren't all of our actions joint action?
That's how we invented the internet. That's how we sent a man to the moon. We rise or fall together as one nation and as one people. You're not on your own. We're in this together.
Is individualism a myth? Can we really do anything on our own?
Our guest is Margaret Gilbert from UC Irvine.
Acting together.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner at Stanford University, where Ken and I are members of the philosophy department.
Today, we're looking at what it means to act together.
Well, Ken, the great English philosopher Thomas Hobbes famously said that in the state of nature, life is solitary, brutish, and short, as if nature designed people to act alone rather than, as Aristotle thought, to be social animals.
Yeah, but Hobbes is wrong and Aristotle's right. Acting together is one of the most natural things in the world. If we never acted together, there'd be no teams, no families, no countries, no dance partnerships. But here's our question. What exactly is it to act together?
Well, I'll get us off to a start. We act together when we're trying to accomplish the same thing.
Well, that seems to be part of it. That surely isn't enough, is it? I mean, suppose we're outside and it starts to rain. We both run toward the door to the studio. We're trying to do the same thing, to get into the studio and out of the rain. Now, even though we're acting at the same time, in the same way, even for the same goal, we aren't acting together, are we?
Well, In this scenario, I mean, it doesn't really fit my definition. We don't really share a goal. You're trying to get yourself out of the rain. I'm trying to get myself out of the rain.
Okay, you don't like my example? You got a better example?
Well, yeah. Suppose my wife Frenchie and I are having a picnic. It starts to rain. I grab the food, put it in the cooler, and run to the car. She folds up the blanket, picks it up, and runs to the car. We're doing something together, something that neither of us would do alone, or could do alone. We're jointly putting the picnic stuff into the car to keep it dry.
Yeah, but in your scenario, you and Frenchie are still performing two separate and distinct actions. Frenchie put the blanket in, you put the food in. There's no togetherness there, is there?
Yes, there is. I mean, your problem is you're looking at the trees rather than the forest. When we act together, we share this overarching goal. Then, between us, we break this goal down into various subtasks. And we divvy those up. We each take responsibility for some and rely on the others, the other person, to do the others. That's acting together.
That seems like a good start. I get your point. But I still think there's something missing. It's a little subtle. So bear with me while I engage in a little thought experiment here. I mean, imagine that your plans, you and Frenchie's plans, you are completely independent. Completely independently of the other, want to get the picnic stuff into the car. Maybe you had a fight and you're not talking anymore. But suppose that neither of you knows the plans of the other or the other's intention. Okay, your plan is to get the food and come back for the blanket. Frenchie's plan is to get the blanket and come back for the food.
Okay, I kind of see your worry. Of course, Frenchie and I never fight, but as a hypothetical example, I'll grant that it has a certain point. We each act together on our independent plans, and kind of by accident, all the stuff gets into the car. But we didn't really do it together, did we?
No, that's right. It seems more like a lucky accident than something the two of you did together, especially nothing you intentionally did together. So that raises the questions. When we're acting together, don't our plans and intention have to be kind of interdependent in the right way?
Well, okay. Turns out that acting together is a pretty complicated thing. We have to share an overarching goal. It seems we have to mutually know that we share this goal. We have to agree on a way of dividing up tasks so that each of our contributions to the common goal dovetails with our partner's contribution, and we have to understand how each other is doing that. And then we all have to be committed and know that the other is committed and know that the other one knows that we're committed.
Wow.
It's getting pretty darn complicated.
Yeah, God, John, we've gotten ourselves into a complicated and hyper-cerebral mess. I mean, let's step back a second. I mean, think of ants. They act together all the time. They build their nest together. They gather their food together. But they don't go around forming complicated beliefs about each other or making elaborate commitments to each other or any of that stuff. Why can't humans be like that?
Well, I'll give you this, Ken. Ants and other animals, too, engage in coordinated activity. But there's a big difference between the instinctive cooperation that animals do so well and the sort of partnerships and shared endeavors that we do, isn't there?
Well, you're right. I guess you're right. And to help us think about that difference, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Ash, to look deeper at shared action in the animal world. She files this report.
Ever wonder how honeybees build exquisite nests of highly regular hexagonal cells, or how ants create anthills with winding bridges, tunnels, and chambers?
There's no such thing as a solitary ant. All ants are highly social.
Stephen Pratt from Arizona State University studies social insects and how they cooperate to produce a kind of collective intelligence.
An ant is kind of like a neuron, you know, in that a single cell in a brain. So a brain, you know, our brains make decisions, and those decisions are products of the entire brain, right? They're not products of a single neuron. There's no sort of master neuron.
For the ant colony, too, group decisions are distributed across all ants. In one experiment, an anthill is destroyed. The colony has two choices where to relocate. One nest is nice and dark, and that's good if you're an ant, but the other is even darker.
The colony will do much better than a solitary ant at detecting those very tiny differences in light level. In other words, if the problem is hard, the colony is better than the individual.
So how do they communicate to pick the better option? Pratt says when an ant finds a good nest, it lays a trail of pheromones. They do this with food too. Each ant has a kind of internal scale, so the better the food source, the thicker the chemical trail. That signals to others, hey, this is good.
And so at the colony level, the colony has chosen the better food source. If you could ask any of those ants, which is the better food source, none of them would be able to tell you, because in fact, for the most part, each of them has only seen one of the two sources.
Insects aren't the only creatures that work together. When a group of chimps is hunting a monkey, it's incredibly coordinated.
They know that they can't do it by themselves. The monkeys are too fast. So they kind of surround the monkey, as it were, and make sure he doesn't escape.
Michael Tomasello studies chimps and children at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Germany.
And then ultimately one of them will end up capturing him, and then there's a kind of a scramble over the food, and they all get some, and it's a very impressive feat.
Chimps don't really need to eat monkeys, so it's not like they're cooperating purely for survival. They're social animals, but there's a limit to how much they'll work together, especially if there's no immediate individual payoff. In some ways, chimps are like small children. They have something called theory of mind, which means they can recognize their own desires, and they know that other apes have their own wants, too.
Interestingly enough, children use this ability to sort of mind read, if you will, to do all kinds of collaborative things. So they can cooperate together and solve tasks. They communicate cooperatively.
But chimps don't always cooperate. They use this ability mainly to compete for food and mates. In one experiment, Tomasello took a pair of chimps, or a pair of children, and made them collaborate to get food through a simple pulley system. But the experiment was rigged, so one child, or one chimp, always got the food first.
And what children do is they see that the other one hasn't gotten any, and they just keep pulling. They put down their food and delay eating it and everything, and they just help the other one, and they see it through till the end.
The chimps, on the other hand...
Anybody who's ever worked with chimps knows what the answer is going to be. If they're pulling in together and one of them gets their food first, game over.
This is interesting because it highlights a key difference between primates and humans. Apes don't need to work together to survive, but at some point in human evolution, people probably did.
I think one of the things that happened in human evolution is that humans came under pressure to cooperate together or not survive, and this put additional pressure on the species to learn how to cooperate for this survival purpose.
So the species as a whole shifts toward cooperation. Humans are committed to their partners. The chimp stops cooperating as soon as his stomach's full. So people evolve to farm and build civilizations, while chimps continue to hunt monkeys. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
Thanks, Caitlin, for that little tutorial about chimps and ants. I'm rather upset, Ken, that chimps eat monkeys. That sounds vaguely cannibalistic, but I suppose that's because I don't know the difference between a chimp and a monkey. I'm just a philosopher, and in fact, I'm John Perry, and with me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
And today, we're asking what it means to act together. We're joined now by Margaret Gilbert. She's a professor of philosophy at the University of California, Irvine. She's author of Joint Commitment, How We Make the Social World. Margaret, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you.
Hi, Margaret. I'm going to ask you this now. What? I don't know if you're basically a social person or a basically a solitary person, but it seems like one or the other must have originally drawn you to this particular philosophical problem. What's the story?
Oh, well, I guess it's sort of a philosophical story. Contemporary philosophy at the time I was working on a doctoral thesis hadn't focused on the social world at all, and I wanted to think about that. It's a pretty big gap. And doing things together is a central part of our social lives. It helps to get things done, as you've emphasized already on the program, and it also gives us exceptional comfort. It's a great loneliness reliever, one might say. So it fulfills a lot of roles in our lives.
Well, for whatever reason, I'm glad you got interested in it. You've produced a lot of very interesting material, and I think the classic example of two people walking down the sidewalk at the same time in the same direction versus two people taking a walk together, maybe that's comes from your work. But tell us, in a nutshell, what is the difference between those two cases?
Well, funnily enough, one can go back to the Bible, I think, and probably get the right answer there.
Oh, dear.
Can be further explained. Yeah, well, lots of good things there. Here's a quote from Amos. Shall two people walk together unless they have agreed? Something with the same structure as an agreement, I think, is what underlies our doing things together, that we don't have to speak and we don't have to actually explicitly agree. So I talk about joint commitment, and the idea is that we commit, the two of us, to stick with a certain goal and aim towards it.
So you said we don't use agreement, commitment, but you also said we don't have to explicitly agree. I mean, it seems right to me explicit agreement is kind of the exception rather than the norm. That's the product of negotiation, but we do all kinds of things together without all this explicit agreement. Because one of the things I worry about these theories of this is that they're so cerebral. I mean, how much of it is just sort of hardwired and automatic as opposed to explicit and reasoned out and all that?
Well, let me say, first of all, that I don't think agreements necessarily involve negotiation. So if you're with a friend and you're not sure what to do that afternoon and the friend says, let's go to the beach, you say, yeah, let's. That's it. There wasn't much negotiation, but you signaled to one another that you had a goal. You proposed a certain goal for the two of you, and that was accepted. So it can be pretty short and sweet as far as agreements go, and it is a way of getting together behind a certain goal. Now, that can be done in less formally. Maybe your friend sees you carrying a towel and says, you going to the beach? And you say yes, and the friend sort of picks up a towel, and then off you go together, and there's a mutual understanding that we're doing this together now. So there are different ways of getting into this, I think, and developing the right understandings.
So it doesn't have to be hyper cerebral and hyper reasoning. Okay, that's good. And we'll dig into this more when we come back. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're asking about shared action, what it means to act together. Our guest is Margaret Gilbert from UC Irvine.
Do you spend most of your day acting alone, or do you act together with others? When you get things done, do you get things done in spite of your partners or because of them?
Agency, intention, and commitment. When Philosophy Talk continues.
When you're on the same team, you're supposed to be acting together. But what does it really mean to act together? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor.
Our guest is Margaret Gilbert from University of California, Irvine. She's the author of Joint Commitment, How We Make the Social World. She'll be part of a live chat in our community of thinkers next Friday, March 21st at noon.
So, Margaret, we talked some about two people acting together. You talked about the friend, one friend grabbing a towel and heading to the beach, the other heading to the beach with him or her. You know, I wonder, is the two-person case like the paradigm of human interaction? Or, I mean, because a lot of the things we do with others, we do with lots of others. How do we get from, your work mostly seems to be focused on the two-person case, but does it add up to multiple agents acting together in coordination?
Well, I wonder if I could just clarify something. My work hasn't actually focused on the two-person case. I wrote a book published in 2006 called A Theory of Political Obligation.
Right.
And it starts with the two-person case as indeed a way into the subject. But then I argue that given the kind of account I give of acting together and walking together, going for a walk together was my example, that one could understand that this could be this sort of structure, this agreement-like structure could be reproduced at greater and greater levels.
So help me think about how it adds up then, how it aggregates up, because it's hard enough to reach agreement and coordinate with one other person. I can kind of understand how that works, but coordinating my behavior with lots of others, you know, the ants are really good at that, but they don't do much thinking or reasoning or believing or committing. How do we pull that off?
Well, I suppose, you know, there are ways of, we can increase the size gradually because we can get it from two to three and then five and six. And let's say, you know, you're a Stanford professor, so you have classes. I don't know how big your classes are, but you might have 40 students perhaps, and you'll say, okay, let's aim to keep this conversation short, or let's try to discuss this topic, in a focused way. And then, I assume your students will get on board with you, and you'll be doing that together. There'll be 40 of you.
So in structuring, looking at larger groups, is there a point at which you take the single human individual to no longer be the agent and, say, change to corporations or political parties or something like that? Or is it individuals are the agents all the way up?
Well, that's a good and a big question, and I haven't focused myself and my own work specifically on corporations, but of course that we develop in larger scale cases, we develop hierarchies, and we, for example, in a big nation, we understand that we will elect a president, for example, and he will make decisions for us, and those decisions will count as our decisions, fortunately or unfortunately.
But I think there's another related to John's question. There's a kind of deeper question here. Here's one thing you could think. I'm not sure what you think, but one could think the following: when two people act together, just start with a two-person case. There's a new kind of agent. A group agent, a kind of a group mind kind of thing. Is acting together like, we newly constituting a group mind that is this now the subject of agency? Part of me thinks that can't be right, because groups aren't the kind of things that can have intentions. An agent has intentions, and right? But so there's only individual agents, and we never kind of aggregate up to a group agent. I mean, what's your view about that? Do we aggregate up to a new kind of agent, a group thing, or is it always just the individuals interrelating kind of thing?
I guess I don't like talking particularly about group minds, because that tends to conjure something a little wild and crazy and impossible. But very routinely in our daily lives, we talk about what we are doing and what we think, what we value. And when we look at that, it doesn't look as if we're talking about what we all believe or what we all value or what we all are doing, for that matter, going back to agency. So, you know, we're building a wall around the city. Well, I'm not building a wall around the city. We are. And it's not true that each of us is building a wall around the city. So something else is going on, and we're ascribing this action to us. So as far as that goes, if you want to say there's a group agent, then, you know, that makes sense, and that can be understood as involving certain processes. So I think there's nothing wrong with talking about group agents as, you know, what we're doing, then there's a group agent if we're doing something.
How about subpersonal agents? I mean, suppose happens every morning. Suppose I'm having difficulty getting out of bed, right? And the way I tend to think of it is, part of me, I have a desire to stay in bed, and that desire kind of works on its own without consulting the rest of my brain and tries to recruit beliefs that will support it and make for motivation. You've got a class to teach, but it's not that important. It's a philosophy class. The students don't care if you're late. maybe it'll rain, you know, who knows? You can, then another desire, a more honorable desire tries to recruit beliefs. No, you got to get there on time. You should be up. You should have your coffee, blah, blah, blah. So it seems to me the person is a kind of an artificial, culturally constructed, thing that people like Ken and maybe yourself believe in because you're so well organized, but for most of us, it really is kind of an abstraction. What do you think of that?
So you're asking me to talk about what an individual amounts to, an individual person,
yeah,
as opposed to a group person.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that I have, apart from being one, I'm not sure I have any special expertise on the individual. So my interest is more in how we might join together. You might say to your spouse, look, please, I don't want to get up in the mornings for my class, so please, let's have an agreement. Let's agree that you'll wake me up. You'll force me to get out of bed. You'll pull me out of bed.
That way
she's come into the picture as your as part of your team.
I have an agreement like that with my cat who jumps on my head.
But John, I guess you're saying, and it seems like a reasonable thought, that social organization, I mean, some people may think of social organization as something new. You get individuals and you have to, this problem of organizing them into collectivities arises, and it only arises when you have the individuals and how to organize them. But I guess you're saying that the problem of organizing the innards to constitute a person isn't so different from the problem of organizing a bunch of persons to constitute a collectivity. Is that?
Well, take maybe a better example is my dog. When I play fetch with my dog, I throw the tennis ball, and she's supposed to run, get the tennis ball, come back, bring it back for a treat. And it works fine until she gets an odd smell or something on the way back. Then she just drops the ball and goes and explores something in a neighbor's yard. And she just seems to be impulse controlled, no kind of overall plan. So there seems to be an analogy to getting training my dog to fetch without getting distracted and getting people to act together for a common goal. But I don't want to push that because it's kind of off the wall.
Well, let me ask you another kind of question, Margaret. Look, you said we have agreements. Are these kind of binding agreements when we act together, or are they exitable agreements? You know, I'm on a team, and if I'm on the team, I'm supposed to do certain things, but sometimes I can just quit the team. And my teammates might be upset, but if I quit the team, there's no team. So is acting together, you know, I mean, is it binding agreements, or are they just exitable at will?
Well, I think they're binding. I think agreements are things that bind, and I've had a certain amount of flack on this over the years since I've been talking about walking together, and one colleague at a conference once said, I'm never going to go for a walk with you. I want to be free to leave whenever I can. I give the example of suppose you have said to somebody, you've agreed to go for a walk and you're on your walk. You understand now the thought is we're out on a walk and we're coming back at a certain point. Maybe that's been agreed on too. So we're walking up to so-and-so, and that's what you're understanding as you go. And then one of you says, okay, I'm off. I think there's more than just surprise as a result. I mean, you think, what's going on? You know, this is not appropriate. I've been offended against. This person's just going off. We're walking together. We're on a walk together. They can't just take themselves out of the picture just like that. So, you know, in fact, there'd be a dialogue like, I can't go any further. I don't think. I'm sorry. I'm going to have to stop. And then the other one says, fine. So the sort of interplay of people, if you observe and think about how it is, when they're doing something together, that you seem to lose your freedom, just as you do with what you call a binding agreement. I mean, I think all agreements are binding. They're agreements. So we obligate each other. We're obligated one to the other to act appropriately to what we're doing. It's a pretty strong tie.
Well, it's a strong tie, but I mean, it seems like it's kind of mild compared to some others. I mean, if I go for a walk with my wife and I walk too fast, she's got a right to be mildly annoyed. I mean, or maybe she doesn't really have the concept of mild annoyance, so let's just say annoyed. But morally outraged, that doesn't seem right. It's a kind of a funny kind of commitment, or I guess it would depend on the task. I mean, if my wife and I were averting World War III by doing something, a rather unlikely scenario, then moral outrage would be involved. But so what kind of commitment is there?
Yeah, well, I mean, I do want to stop you, you know, say I'm not talking about moral outrage. I think actually this is outside the domain of morality. Mm-hmm. That's something, it's a hard sell that people would hear the word right and hear the word obligation and not think of morality. But I think that's actually a mistake, because there can be honor among thieves. We all know that phrase. you know, we've agreed to do something terrible, but we still, I think one clue here is that we have what I refer to as the standing to demand that the person come back on track, and the standing to rebuke them for not being on track. That's a very key thing. So, you know, your wife might call out to you, hey, you know, hey, what do you think you're doing? You know, I can't keep up with that pace. And she could say it in quite a sort of, you know, testy way.
Yes, she could.
She's rebuked. Yeah, well, I don't know her. I know she's lovely, but you know, she could rebuke you. Whereas, you know, you wouldn't say, "What right do you have to rebuke me?" She has an entitlement to, mm-hmm. in a way, act in a punitive manner. Now, you know, we can just set morality aside. We just stop using, you know, don't think of the word morality, but think of how we gain a kind of authority over one another when we're engaged in these joint activities.
A moral theorist might think, well, that's an idea that might help us understand morality, because we kind of have this non-moral obligation, and we might use that to explain how morality got started. Is that an appealing idea?
It's a very appealing idea, because I think that one way, I mean, this is like imagining it. One thing is that we can indeed have bad arrangements, morally bad arrangements, and somebody might, you know, the person with moral vision will stand outside our arrangements, and these might be social arrangements. You know, they might be our social norms and conventions and our goals, and say, these are bad. We have to stop. So even though we've obligated each other to act in certain ways, and we've got the standing to demand that we act in these ways, that is sort of morally neutral. And the moral visionary can say, we've got to stop this practice. We've got to stop this action.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about acting together with Margaret Gilbert. Anthony from San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Anthony.
Interesting conversation. Many, many years ago, when I was in college, I took a political science class. And they started with Hobbes, Locke, and Rousseau, struggling with this question of how did human beings learn to cooperate with one another. And I was a biology major, and that just seemed completely backwards to me. We weren't these fully formed, sentient, autonomous human beings living in perfect isolation, and then we needed to figure out how to cooperate. We evolved in a social structure in these roving bands of 20 to 50 individuals. And that's the context in which we became human beings. So it just seemed like they were struggling with a problem that did not exist.
Well, thank you. Thanks for the call, Anthony. Margaret, you got any response to that?
Well, gosh, certainly it sounds like, yes, we did start out in small roving bands. We got together, acting together, something we've been doing for millennia. I suppose, you know, we're still always going to have to decide what to do. There's going to be, you know, we're not pre-programmed in any particular activities. Well, maybe one or two, but not that many. So a lot of the time we're creating our goals, and that's a novelty.
Right. But I think the caller's under something deep and important. Human beings are, I think he's right. Human beings are evolved social creatures. And moreover, you know, there are lots of social animals, but sociality is not even the norm in the animal community. It's kind of a solution to a kind of problem that it evolves. And our form of sociality, this thing that you're focused on, I think is a rich and cool and late-coming thing and very much worth exploring. And I think too much philosophy of the past started out ignoring the fact that human beings are given the social life as a problem, and they're given means of solving that, and much of our brain and our cognition and this mind-reading module that Tomasello mentioned, that's kind of built into us and gives rise to our sociality. Do you disagree with that?
Well, actually, I think, you know, let me try to mount a little bit of a defense of Hobbes and Rousseau and Locke, and this wouldn't necessarily be the defense they would give. But one has to understand what it is that's innate or what it is that's biologically created. So that if somebody like myself is looking at what it is, you know, what is it? What are the understandings that we have? Then that's what we're talking about. So in having these rather artificial discussion-sounding setups of the state of nature, and then we go from the state of nature through, I guess they talk about the social contract, you could say that they're trying to explain what it is to be social. And perhaps the state of nature is a fiction, but we have to understand what it is that we've been involved to do. evolutionary theory doesn't tell us what we've got.
I agree with that, but I still think that the propensity for sociality and the capacity for sociality is kind of there from the beginning, and I don't think Hobbes, I'm not sure about Rousseau, but I don't think Hobbes had a fair enough appreciation of that. He thinks of sociology as a solution to a problem that we're given by nature, but I just don't think he's got the right starting point. But we can talk about this and other things in more depth as we continue. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about acting together, joint action, with Margaret Gilbert from UC Irvine.
If there's hope for our poor, tired, overpopulated, overheated world, it must be through cooperative activity, maybe on an immense scale. Can there be any hope of this happening? Do philosophers have anything to contribute conceptually to making it more likely?
Individualism, social agency, and the threatening catastrophe. When Philosophy Talk continues.
Every boy, girl, woman, and man acting together. Nice idea, but does it really happen? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Margaret Gilbert from UC Irvine. And we're asking about what it means to act together. Margaret will be part of our live chat on our community of thinkers next Friday, March 21st, noon Pacific time. Join that chat.
So we've got an email here that kind of connects in an interesting way with what Ken and Margaret were talking about. This is from Alvin. He says, I once read a newspaper article that described how early villages got together when they discovered that when they had a pile of grain and it rained, the grain fermented the water. This was an early form of beer, and they had to get together to grow a big enough crop so they could pool the harvest and make beer. So this is a great idea that beer is responsible for society, and today we can see that marijuana is creating a new state out of Colorado from the disarray it used to be in. So
is there a deeper philosophical point there?
Yeah. If we can get together to make beer, let's get together to make peace. I'll let you and Margaret get to the deeper philosophical point of that.
Do you think you see a deeper philosophical point here, Margaret?
Well, there's strength in numbers. There are things that we can't do alone that we can do together, and we may need a huge amount of people.
So let me ask you a question that goes back to our roving philosophical reporter. The chimps and the ants and the bees, there are all kinds of cooperation in nature. Nature seems to have gotten onto this trick about coordinated activity kind of early in the history of evolved things. But human beings have a pretty distinctive form of coordinated activity, this ability to make commitments and all that stuff and to hold each other commitments. I mean, is there stuff that we can do that they can't do because of that? I mean, why this distinctive, what's the benefit of this distinctive form of coordination that human beings engage in, would you say?
I mean, a sort of simple answer is that we have, well, let's just use this word, we have a form of freedom that perhaps the animals lack or have less of. We can really go any which way individually, certainly once we're mature. So we have a need perhaps of a different kind of tie, not the instinctual one, but one which binds us together through our understanding.
Well, that's really interesting, but that's as much problem as potential, as it were, right? There's a potential for really upside forms of cooperation, massive forms of cooperation and coordination when we get all this buy-in and we can, and we're not the prisoner of fixed instincts and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, it also makes for the possibility of failures of coordination on a massive scale. So isn't it a mixed bag, this human capacity? Because you're talking about the two people going for a walk and our entitlement to hold our partner. But what if the other guy just quits and just says, I quit. I'm not doing this anymore. I'm not cooperating with you anymore. That kind of thing is possible on massive scales, and isn't that a problem? Because when the other guy quits, whether or not I'm entitled to hold him to keep walking, I'm certainly pissed at him for not walking anymore.
So Ken, it sounds like you kind of want to go back to Cain and Abel and say that, look, the hunter-gatherer, that was about as much cooperation as we could count on. This whole agricultural stuff and the thousands of years of increasingly complicated structures that have come after it, and look where it's left us. We're sitting here in San Francisco worried about the Crimea. How crazy is that?
Well, that's one way you could go with that. But I'm wondering, you know, there's as much potential for failure, because you said these are binding agreements, you said morality, but people exit these things all the time, and people are searching for kind of partners but can't find them, or people have partners and they feel betrayed, and all this stuff happens.
Yeah, it's sort of the stuff of opera, isn't it?
Yeah.
Betrayal, the broken promise. I think practically every opera you ever see has got a broken promise in it somewhere. So, of course, we're vulnerable to these things breaking up, but we also have understandable means like demands and rebukes, and one can rebuke somebody to the point of, you know, splitting up with them, telling them, you know, I won't walk with you again, the kind of thing Hume talks about, that, you know, if you break enough promises, you won't be trusted, you won't be able to make a promise, and that's... These kinds of things are there, too, to stabilize matters somewhat.
So I want to try out something on you. Go back to the demands and rebukes and all that, and the walking together, and the person decides to quit the walk. You said, I mean, I can see two kinds of criticisms. You said, so you, Frenchie might say to John, I can't keep up at this pace, you know, and that's a rebuke. And that's a rebuke she's kind of entitled to make to the extent that they're engaged in the joint activity of walking together. But what if John says, I no longer want to walk with you. You're too slow. I'm leaving. And just doesn't give her, I mean, that he would be a lousy husband. But would he have, I mean, except being a lousy husband, isn't he free? It sounded like you think once you engage in the walk joint activity, you're not free to just exit. But that doesn't seem right to me. It seems right right that as long as you're still engaged, then the person has a basis internal to the activity for rebuking you when you don't do it right. But if you just say, I exit, they don't have any standing to say, you must keep doing this.
Well, you know, obviously you can. You can just walk away. You have that within your physical power. And sometimes that's a very good thing, because actually what you're doing is a bad thing, not in the case of John and his wife going for a walk. But sometimes you're doing a bad thing, and somebody who quits is taking the moral high ground. But I think it's under, you know, part of the understanding that I think most people would have if you made an agreement that one doesn't have the option of unilaterally rescinding it, saying the agreement's over. You know, I think people may vary in that respect, but generally, I think the understanding is this is something that requires two or more to make, and two or more to rescind.
Think about right? two Nazi co-conspirators who up to some really evil deed, and one of them has a change of heart and says, right. I'm not going to do that evil deed. We would applaud the Nazi for not doing that evil deed.
Absolutely.
Now, his Nazi co-conspirator might complain, but does that complaint really have any standing?
Well, I think what the co-conspirator is doing is saying we had an agreement, you know, we jointly committed each other. I have the standing to complain. But if he also has a moral epiphany, he won't complain. If he hasn't had a moral epiphany, he will complain. So I, you know, it gets complicated. But people, you know, I guess one could say life is complicated. And a lot of the time, when there is no moral issue, then you feel bound. You are somewhat bound. And this other person has a kind of authority over you, which I think goes so far as you walk away, they can call out something negative. And that would be fair. You just split off without asking their permission.
So, Margaret, in the tease for this segment, I said that we were going to see if we could say something helpful to our tired, overpopulated, and overheated planet. Now, due to the work of yourself and Michael Bratman and going back Alvin Goldman and John Searle and Donald Davidson, we understand action philosophically and joint action and cooperative action much better than we did 30 or 40 years ago. As I lived through those 30 or 40 years ago, and I could talk on and on about joint action now, and I couldn't have said two paragraphs 30, 40 years ago. Is all this going to help us with the huge joint actions that are needed to save our poor planet? I mean, even there in the London, in Irvine, near the lovely beaches of the Pacific, things are changing. What are we going to do? Philosophers have anything to help there?
Well, I suppose there's a very general kind of sense that we're not just all, we don't have to be just atomic individuals pursuing our own personal ends, but we can join together and we can think and value together certain things, try to get other people on board, and then we'll have more power. We join forces, that's a lovely phrase, and the sum of our forces, our joined forces, can accomplish more than what us acting randomly as individuals can accomplish.
That's a nice thought, and I like that thought, and I certainly share that thought, Donna, so I don't mean to criticize it by the following remark. But okay, yeah, we've got the possibility of joint action, and we can achieve all things, but actually achieving joint action for these hard things like global warming and all that has proven to be really, really difficult. I mean, are there some conceptual tools that come from work like yours or Bratman, or is that just a completely different thing that will help us understand why they're so difficult and maybe surmount the difficulties?
Well, I think these things that are difficult, and there's a lot of self-interest that goes against what might be good for everybody and for the planet. So I guess perhaps we have to raise moral consciousness, which isn't something that... that the shared activity necessarily involves. We want to do good things together. Let's
right.
find out what the good things
right.
are and let's do them.
But of course, we also want to do. I mean, is it the problem that human cooperation? Here's something I sometimes think, and tell me if you agree or disagree. The humans are evolved to cooperate. We're basically evolved to cooperate in the small circle, face-to-face cooperation where there's hard mm-hmm. possibility of exit. The global world has made this huge cooperation problem that our brains weren't really evolved to deal with, and that's part of the difficulty, that the small-scale cooperation that we're really good at doesn't easily aggregate up to these massive coordination problems.
Well, that's a good point. Well, that's a good point. I mean, that's a point about how we evolved, and indeed, this might be difficult. So perhaps we have to have individual chapters of larger groups. You know, we do, obviously, in many contexts. So we have the local chapter, but it might all be, everything might be aiming towards a common goal that goes beyond that.
Well, with the world as a whole, it seems to me there's really kind of two problems. When there's something like an asteroid coming towards Earth, or even this lost Malaysian airliner, a lot of cooperation seems forthcoming immediately. But when you talk about cooperating for long-term future goals, I'm pretty pessimistic.
Well, me too. Margaret, are you pessimistic or optimistic? Last word here.
Oh, I think optimism always wins. You have to be optimistic.
Well, I'm going to thank you for being optimistic. I'm going to thank you for joining this conversation. It's been a cooperative and fun endeavor. Thank you so much, Margaret.
Thank you. Thanks. Bye.
Our guest has been Margaret Gilbert. She's a professor of philosophy at the University of California, Irvine. She's author of Joint Commitment, How We Make the Social World. So, John, what are we thinking today?
Well, when I first heard this topic broached, I thought we were going to talk about Colorado and the fact that joint action is really going to be legal soon. But this was also an interesting topic, so I'm glad we got to it. I really do think the philosophy of action, Margaret Gilbert, Michael Bratman, and all these things, it's been a great ride for philosophy over the last 40 years, and a wonderful new discipline that's been very insightful.
And we've actually made some philosophical progress at understanding a really hard and complicated thing, and it's spreading to economics and psychology. Cool stuff. A lot more we could say about it, though. And this conversation about it will continue and has already begun at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And don't forget that you're invited to join in our live chat with Margaret Gilbert at our community of thinkers next Friday, March 21st at noon. Be part of the conversation. And also, you can become a partner in that community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now, it doesn't take a village to get this guy up to speed. Let's hear from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, I'm a bit of a loner myself. Always have been, setting small fires on the edge of town type of guy. Quiet, keep to myself, wouldn't hurt a fly. But I'm known to join with others from time to time, whether it's for poker or pick up ball game in the park, protesting against some war or the other, or back when I was a kid, marching in a band and gang fights. Those who band together are often transparent in their groupiness, like a football team or a motorcycle gang. But some groups are mysterious to me. Hippies, for instance. Hippies are an instantly defined and easily recognizable group, and yet the hippie ethos, ingredients, do your own thing, travel light, let it all hang out, peace, man, so forth, don't really seem like group activities per se. Hippies were so laid back, would have been hard to tell who's a hippie and who's not if their attire did not alert you, the long hair, the beards, the unshaven legs, the beads, the bell-bottom sandals, the tie-dye, because being a hippie seemed a lot cooler than, say, studying. Many high schoolers affected the hippie look back in the day in the hope that they might one day have sex with a real hippie. Should one show up at the high school. So you can be a hippie without actually being a hippie at all. Not only that, the real hippies were so laid back, they had a high tolerance for weekend hippies, phony hippies. Instead of long hair, these wannabes sprouted sideburns. They often wore narrow jackets with beads and smelled like patchouli oil. These young men were actually realtors, dentists, and shoe store managers who hoped by dressing this way, a hippie chick might actually enter the store, actually buy a pair of sensible shoes with the disposable income they suddenly and magically had, and might actually have sex with them back in the shoe room because, hey, that's how hippie chicks roll. Now, of course, though they are still around, everybody hates hippies, and most everybody hates Ayn Rand libertarians. Curiously, Stuart Brand, the guy who founded the Whole Earth Catalog, that real-world precursor to the World Wide Web, wrote an op-ed piece for Time magazine in 1995 in which he said that, quote, hippie communalism and libertarian politics form the roots of the modern cyber revolution, unquote. Well, that sounds about right to me, but what happened to that cyber revolution anyway? Well, there was the dot-com crash, and then Web 2.0, and now the hippie hipsters at Facebook just paid $19 billion for a photo, video, and texting app. That means that we, as a Facebook users group, will have much easier access to and more choices of mobile messaging as individual Facebook users. Right on. The revolution rolls on. Of course, it's not really the age of Aquarius, and it won't be until somebody comes up with an app for it. On the bright side, the revolution still will not be televised, and there won't be many group shots either. But it will be chock full of selfies. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2014.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Dave Millar is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Carola Kreitmeier, Jimmy Tobin, Jill Covington, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
Oh, and thanks for thinking too.
Well, we made it here first. All thanks to teamwork.
Yeah, my teamwork.